quite a number of years ago, when I was in first or second grade, I can't quite remember which one, I noticed at lunchtime that some of my Jewish friends were bringing their peanut butter and jelly on something called matzah. And upon inquiring about this, I was informed that it was for something called Passover. Now, I can't remember. I might have been aware at the time that Passover had something to do with the parting of the Red Sea. I'm not sure. But I can't quite remember how familiar I was with that specific part of the Bible story. But either way, that explanation satisfied my curiosity. Life went on. It wasn't until I was about 18 that an interest in these things began to warrant deeper examination. Up until that time, I was satisfied with the explanation I got in second grade. Even though I've learned significantly more over the years, no matter how much my understanding has deepened, I always feel like there's more to be learned. Because it seems that the more you learn, the more you know you need to learn. There's always more. Every question answered seems to bring up another question. I have never been satisfied with my present understanding at the time. Some of you may feel similar. Now, I suspect my now older Jewish friends who still participate in this understand that Passover pictures more than God delivering Israel from slavery, even though that is the main focus of their celebration. The spirit of Passover goes beyond that to a celebration of redemption from all slavery and oppression. So my Jewish friends would see the matzah, or unleavened bread, as having the dual meaning of both slavery and freedom. Those dual concepts are also familiar to us as Christians. Perhaps not in the same sense, because Christ taught that one can be completely free from human oppression, yet still be in slavery, the slavery of sin. Until one is freed from the slavery of sin, they're not truly free. Now, the overarching theme of Passover is redemption through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. After all, this is the holiday that celebrates God's intervention in history to lead the Israelites from slavery to freedom. For us, it is a time to celebrate God as the great liberator of humanity from the ultimate slavery, which is sin. At the same time, though, we also reflect on our roles as redeemed people who now belong to Christ. The eating of unleavened bread helps to remind us of our role in this redemptive process. Throughout the Bible, God uses patterns or templates to teach these important concepts to his people. For instance, Abraham offering Isaac pictures the sacrifice of Christ. You know, same place, actually. And these events build on one another on various templates. Different circumstances, yet the same basic themes repeated and rehearsed through the Bible. As we eat unleavened bread for the next week, we are reminded that to escape the slavery of sin, we need to put sinful practices out of our lives in order to become a new lump, as Paul says, a new person in Christ, governed by God as a willing citizen of his kingdom, putting into practice those things that lead to life. So what I want to do today, I want to illustrate that our participation in eating unleavened bread reflects the most important as well as the most basic pattern or template of Scripture. To do this, I want to use an event that happened to Israel when they first entered the wilderness. But before they go there, I kind of want to set this thing up a little bit. So I'm going to begin in Exodus 14, and of course that's the parting of the Red Sea. We all know what led up to this, the plagues in Egypt. As they got worse and more severe, finally, with the death of the firstborn, Pharaoh basically said, not only could they go, but please go and go now. So they left. They come to the Red Sea, and in verse 1 of Exodus 14, now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. So God is setting Pharaoh up here. He's not finished. He's going to make a point that we see later on was rather effective. For Pharaoh will say to the children, will say of the children of Israel, they're bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. They're lost. They're trapped by the sea. Let's go get them. Verse 4, I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. It was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people, and they said, why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? So he made ready his chariot, took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt, with captains over every one of them. And again, the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and they go and pursue them, and they come near them. And in verse 10, when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, so that they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, and then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, you have led us, taken us away to die in the wilderness. Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? We don't get it. We don't see the outcome here. This doesn't make any sense to us. What's going on here? Bear in mind that they just experienced miraculous plagues in Egypt, but so quickly, when it looks bad, they complain. And not that they didn't have, you know, a reason to complain. It didn't look very good. I don't know how much they were aware. Moses was aware of God's plan, but I don't know how much they were. But Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will see no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. And the Lord said to Moses, what are you crying to me for? What are you standing around for? Go forward. But lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go through the ground, on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And, of course, he's going to harden Pharaoh's heart. Pharaoh's going to go after him. There was a while where the pillar of the cloud moved behind Israel, between the Egyptians and the Israelites. They still tried to pursue. He was giving the chariots problems, taking the wheels off. So much so that the Egyptians weren't blind idiots. They knew something was going on. In fact, I read something somewhere that by the time God released the waters of the Red Sea and they came back upon them, the Egyptians were already trying to get out because they could see, where does it say? Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. Let's get out of here. We're in over our heads. Literally. And the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. The Israelites walked on dry ground. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and they saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. And Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. After seeing this magnificent miracle, they believed. They believed the Lord and his servant Moses. When we go over to 15, that, you know, if you think about what they saw, and evidently, you know, I do. I have the image of the Cecil B. DeMille movie, The Ten Commandments, where Charlton Heston holds up his hand and rod, and the sea just like whoosh, opens right up. But this probably took place over a number of hours because a strong east wind blew all night to make the sea open. So they could watch this happen over a period of time. How magnificent must that have been? What must they have thought? I mean, that... That is probably one of the greatest miracles in the history of miracles. And they knew it. So in chapter 15, they celebrated. They were celebrating. God can do it. God overthrew Egypt, the mightiest land on earth. You know, he delivered us from the hands of, he destroyed Egypt. God can do anything. He's great. He's wonderful. He is. And they knew it. And the celebration goes and goes and goes. All the way down to verse 21. Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea. Now we come to the event that I want to focus on. Exodus 15, 22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. Then they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days into the wilderness, and they found no water. I find this next verse humorous for some reason, because keep in mind, Marah means bitter, so I'm going to read it. Now when they came to Bitter, they could not drink the waters of Bitter because they were bitter. That's why it's called Bitter. Everybody get that? The waters are bitter. And the people complained against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? Are you kidding me? 3 days ago, you saw the greatest miracle in the history of miracles, and now you're like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And they complain against Moses. I know that God said in Deuteronomy 28 that he never gave Israel a heart to believe throughout all their wanderings. So he never really gave them a heart to believe. But still, I mean, this is like we witnessing the parting of the Red Sea on the Sabbath. And here we are Tuesday. That's 3 days. They must have been talking about it during their journey. What a wonderful thing it was. And here they are 3 days later. And right away, they're ready to throw Moses under the bus. Now, granted, I do believe they were thirsty, because that's the only thing that explains it to me. They were thirsty. They really did need water. We pick it up in verse 25. So he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. When he cast it in the waters were made sweet. There he made a statute and an ordinance for him, and there he tested them. So, what's going on here? I don't know about you, but all I get in my head is a bunch of questions. When you say bitter, do you mean bitter like taste bad, or bitter make you sick, or bitter kill you? And how'd you find out about that? Was it already named Marah when you got there? Or did somebody inadvertently drink it and get sick or die? Or were there like the Old West water holes, there's skeletons laying around, you know, people who drank it and died. What about this tree? I mean, like the whole tree with the roots, or did you cut it off, or just a branch or a piece of wood that you threw in the water? And what species of wood would do that to this water? All these questions. All these questions are totally irrelevant to what's going on here. That's how I read. I read analytically, and when I read scripture, it's like I'm trying to extract information, pull it out as much as I can get. That doesn't always work. The Bible, we read sometimes as if it were a history book or a science book. It's not a history book. Is there history in it? Yeah. Yeah, there is. It contains historical information. But it's historical information written through the eyes of the prophets who were under God's inspiration to get a message or a point across, not history for the sake of history. Science, is there science in it? Maybe. But it's not a science book. And you can't inject science in to try to understand it. First and foremost, we need to try and allow it to communicate to us what the writer is intending to get across. And sometimes we just need to back off and let the story come to us. So let's try to do this. Because it's taken a while for me to understand, but oftentimes when the Bible is written, it makes its point using an economy of words. There's not a lot of extra information there, which drives me crazy sometimes because I'd like to know some things. And we're not given it because it's not important. It's not important to what's being communicated to us. So what do we know here? Israel needed water. They were facing death. They didn't get water. They were going to die. How did they get here? God led them here. God obviously led them here for a purpose. We find out it was to prove them. There's an important point that we need to keep in mind when we read this story, and it's in 1 Corinthians 10. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11, as soon as you see it, you'll recognize it. Paul talking to the Corinthians, telling them about the events that we're reading about here in the Old Testament, he says, "Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come." So this is an example for us. It happened to them, but it's just as important for us to understand what happened. So 3 days after they crossed the Red Sea, they're thirsty. So we know that this takes place in a place called Marah, which means bitter. But it's also significant to understand that it's more than Marah. Because if you remember, they went up into the wilderness of Shur. The word Shur means wall. Now, there's a parallel account of their journeys in Numbers 33:8. And there, they say, they went up into the wilderness of Etham. Etham means fort. So we have fort, wall. Where is this place? Well, this is the frontier, the outer frontier of Egypt. This is the place where technically they are leaving the environs of Egypt. From here on out, they are no longer in Egypt. This is the outer border of the land. In other words, they are leaving at the point right now, they are leaving slavery behind it, and they are transitioning to free people. So the timing of that helps us understand something, because you're going to be a free person from now on. How are you going to live your life? How are you going to conduct yourself? Well, in verse 23, we see... let me go back there to Exodus 15. So they came to Marah. They could not drink the waters of Marah because they were Marah. That's why it was called Marah. The people complained against Moses, "What shall we drink?" It's interesting because the test they just had 3 days ago was a water test. This is a water test. It seemed like throughout their journeyings, they had a lot of water tests. So they complained against Moses. What should have been their course of action? They were thirsty. They did need water. God brought them here. But they complained against Moses. What should have been their course of action? They should have cried out to the Lord. That's what they should have done. Lucky for them, that's what Moses did. Moses cried out to the Lord. Now, I said this was the second water test. If we go ahead two chapters, you get to a place where Israel was thirsty again and they needed water to stay alive. And at the Red Sea, God told Moses, "Take your staff in your hand, lift up your hands." The water parted. At the rock, God said, "Moses, take your staff, strike the rock, water will come out." So wouldn't it make sense here to have Moses take his staff, either wave it over the water or stick it in the water or smite the water, something with his staff like the other times? God was doing something different. God is teaching us and teaching them something. It said, he showed Moses a tree. Now that word show is the Hebrew verb yara. It means to show or to point or to teach. So he taught Moses about this tree by showing him. The verb yara is the verb form of the noun Torah, which means teaching or law. So we see that there's a little more than meets the eye here. So about this tree. What was it? It says it's a tree. Good enough for me. I'm not going any further with it. I'm allowing the story to talk to me. It's a tree. Moses takes the tree that God showed him and threw it in the water. The water became drinkable. Israel's life was saved because the water was good. The water was made good because the tree that was thrown in there made it good. In other words, the tree saved Israel's life. By healing the water, the tree brought Israel life. That would make it a what? A tree of life. Now, what does our mind naturally think about here? Well, it's like a link back to Genesis 2, the tree of life. That's what it's meant to do. Let's go back to Genesis 2. We read about the Garden of Eden, how God planted the garden. He planted the tree of life in the midst of the garden. What did he say? Of all the trees in the garden, you may freely eat, except for the tree of knowing good and bad, or knowledge of good and evil. I kind of like knowing good and bad. Except for that tree. Let me ask you a question. What did Adam and Eve need to do to eat from the tree of life? You may freely eat. What did they have to do? They had to walk up to the tree of life and eat from it. That's all. It was free for the taking. But was that all? Did they have to do anything else? Didn't they have to walk past the tree of knowing good and bad and not eat from it to take from the tree of life? Yes. They had to choose not to eat from the tree of knowing bad, and then freely they could have walked up and partaken of the tree of life. Let's go back to Exodus 15. So we have this idea of the tree of life being a template of a choice, of the fundamental choice that faces each and every one of us. How are we going to conduct our lives? If we go back to Exodus 15... we read that in verse 26, he said, if you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. So, doesn't this sound a little bit like a choice? That God is telling them to make a choice to follow him, to do his commandments, just like Adam and Eve had a choice to lean to their own understanding or to follow God. It's interesting that it's kind of phrased with the diseases that he has brought on the Egyptians, right? That's the punishment for not doing his commandments and following him. And I wondered, you know, why is that? How comes that is? I mean, it's certainly diseases that they would be familiar with, but, you know, human diseases are pretty much human diseases. I think there's more going on here. And Amos 5:25 reveals something to us to tell us what might be happening here. Amos 5 in verse 25. Amos is chastising Israel for not, as usual, not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And he's being a little sarcastic here. He says, "Did you offer me sacrifice and offerings in the wilderness 40 years, O house of Israel? You also carried Sikketh your king and Cheon your idols, the star of your gods, which you made for yourselves." They never really left behind the gods of Egypt. Now here we are back in Exodus 15, and we're at a place where they're leaving Egypt behind. Obviously, they weren't leaving the gods of Egypt behind. This was a problem. And God tells them he's going to put the plagues of Egypt on them. So they're here at Marah, and they can't drink the water. What was the first plague that God brought on the Egyptians? Water to blood. So is God telling them, you guys are going in the same direction here that the Egyptians went into? You're not forsaking their gods. You're going right down the same path. Here's a little taste again of the same kind of trial that I gave Egypt. For some reason, all this talking about water has made me thirsty. Could somebody send up my Yeti? Thank you, my dear. So right here in the very beginning of leaving slavery and Egypt, God cautions Israel against not following him and taking to themselves knowing good and bad. Ah, sweet water. Let's add another layer. There are five books of the Bible that are known as the wisdom books or the wisdom literature. They're Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. These are written with the intent to impart wisdom. You could say that they are desirable to make one wise. Does that statement ring a bell? Isn't that kind of what Eve said about the tree of knowing bad? It was desirous to make one wise. We desire wisdom. God wants us to have wisdom. While God's wisdom is free for the taking, it comes at a price. Like I said, one must walk past the tree of knowledge of good and evil, or knowing good and bad, by putting aside self and submitting to God. Another way to say this is not to walk by sight, leaning to our own understanding. Not determining what is good in our own eyes, but to walk by faith, allowing God to determine what's good and bad. I think for beings that have free moral agency, the natural tendency is we want to lean to our own understanding because things make sense to us. You know, today's a beautiful day. What makes sense to the natural person is to be outside, you know, golfing or riding bike or having some activity. The last thing they think of is being inside here at a church service. It's not natural. The natural man does not think that way. That's why it says in Romans 8:7 that the carnal mind is enmity against God. It's not subject to the law of God. It can't be, because it's natural. It wants to do what comes naturally to it. Let's go over to Proverbs 1. Proverbs 1. Just to preface this, the wisdom books, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man, knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase learning, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel, to understand a proverb and an enigma, the words of the wise and their riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and understanding. Gaining wisdom, knowing good and bad, rightly begins with a fear in the sense of respect and reverence of the Lord. Obviously, Adam and Eve did not have that fear or that respect because they did not listen to what he said. They chose their own way, their own method of gaining wisdom. How'd that work? How's it working? Look around our world. We are in desperate need of healing on so many levels. Leaning to our own understanding does not lead where we want it to. Let's go over to chapter 2, 6, one page over. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. That's what Adam and Eve missed. God wanted them to have wisdom. He wanted them to be educated and have knowledge and understanding, but it had to come from him because he knows right and wrong. He can spare us a world of hurt by allowing him to teach us. They chose a wrong pursuit of knowledge. Over in Proverbs 3, beginning in verse 1, My son, do not forget my law, but let your heart keep my commands. For length of days and long life and peace they will add to you. Do not let mercy and truth forsake you. Bind them around your neck and write them on the tablet of your heart. And so find favor and high esteem in the sight of God and man. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him and he shall direct your paths. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil. This is what eating unleavened bread pictures. It pictures gaining wisdom the right way. If you would, just drop down to verse 18 here. Talking about wisdom. What do they say? She is a tree of life. Wisdom is a tree of life. Christ came to save us and make us righteous. Does anyone care to guess what Proverbs says the fruits of righteousness are likened to? A tree of life. That's in Proverbs 11:30. Proverbs 11:30. The fruit of righteousness is a tree of life, and he who wins souls is wise. In Proverbs 13, it's referred to fulfilled desire is referred to as a tree of life. In 15:4, a wholesome tongue is a tree of life. The tree of life template is used to illustrate good things that bring life or lead to life. Things like wisdom and righteousness, controlling ourselves, controlling our tongue, expressing our love for God through obedience and reverence. These things are trees of life. I want to add one more layer. This will sound a little familiar because we read some of this recently. I want to go to John 1. I'll begin in verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. John 6:48. A Let's just go through these rather quickly. I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate man in the wilderness. They're dead. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world. Verse 53, most assuredly I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. John 11, in verse 25. I am, Jesus says, the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? Nowhere does the Bible explicitly say that Jesus is the tree of life. Does it have to? I mean, we can see the tree of life motif in Jesus. Now, having said that, if you're like me, you're already thinking of a couple scriptures in Revelation. Revelation 2:7. Where this is, the tree of life is held out as a reward for those who overcome in Ephesus. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. And in 22:14, it says Jesus will give the right to those who overcome to eat from the tree of life. So what are we to make of this? You know, how could we eat of the tree of life now when it's a future thing for us? Well, consider 1 John 3:2. Beloved, 1 John 3:2, beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. But we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Revelation 19:7-9 talk about the wedding ceremony of the Lamb. Blessed are those, I'm just going to read it. Revelation 19, because I like the way it sounds. Revelation 19:7. Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his wife has made herself ready. And to her it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen, clean and bright. For the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. Then he said to me, write, blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true sayings of God. And I fell at his feet to worship him. And he said to me, oh, I'm sorry, I don't want to read that far. But anyway, at the wedding supper of the Lamb, we will be one with Christ, joined with Christ in a way that we can't really do that now in the flesh. We can't be that complete oneness with Christ because we're still flesh and blood. However, that doesn't mean we can't partake of that now and work towards that. It's like a lot of prophecies where it's now and not yet at the same time. At that time, we will truly be one, eating with the tree of life. Now, we're introduced to the tree of life in the first book of the Bible, Genesis, second chapter. And the tree of life template carries through all the way to the last chapter, Revelation 22. I'd like to just go over there, Revelation 22:2. Now, keep in mind that Revelation is a book of symbolism. Don't try to turn it into reality, because it's symbolic. And nowhere is that more apparent here than in verse 2. Figure out how this works. In the middle of its street and on either side of the river was the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, each tree yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. So how can it be on either side of the river and in the middle of the street at the same time? Well, if it's symbolic, it can be. It can be. Because where does it get its nourishment? If we go back up to verse 1, and he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and the Lamb. The tree of life draws its life from the living water that proceeds from God and the Lamb. It bore 12 fruits, one fruit for every month. What does that mean? It always has fruit on it. There is never a time that the tree of life does not have fruit on it. It is available for the eating all the time, always. Always in season. Its leaves were for the healing of the nations. Now, besides being on either side of the river, it's in the middle of the street. What does that mean? Where does the street go? The street leads into the city of God, the New Jerusalem. You can't really walk and enter the New Jerusalem on the street without passing by the tree of life. It's right there. It has a prominent position. You've got to go past the tree of life to get into the city of God. And I think this is showing the importance of the tree of life. And as I said, it is powered or nourished by the pure river of water of life, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. Think about John 7:37, the last great day of the feast. What does Christ do? What does he say? If anyone thirst, let him come unto me and drink. The Samaritan woman at the well. You're going to draw water and you're going to get thirsty again. I can give you water that will satisfy your thirst. Just like Israel being thirsty back at Marah, they did not have the water of life. The tree of life healed the water, and they lived. These templates are overlaid with different stories throughout Scripture. So bringing this around full circle then, we have a choice to make. When we eat unleavened bread, when God commands us to, can you see the big picture? We're not doing what seems natural to us. Eating unleavened bread is not natural. Eating leavened bread is natural. But choosing to eat the unleavened bread God directs us to eat, doing what God says, not what comes naturally to us. Now, true, eating unleavened bread does not mean we automatically would do the things that are pictured by it. Like consistently eating the bread that came down from heaven, Christ. In other words, following Jesus. Or living sincere lives according to the truth, like Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 5. Or recognizing that in this life, we eat the bread of affliction by taking up our cross daily to follow Christ's example. Now, I will say that the bread of affliction, I don't think we can really appreciate it the way they did. I mean, bread was the central part of their diet. For me personally, it's more of a bread of affliction because I eat too much of it along with the unleavened treats that accompany it this time of year. That's about the way it works for me as the bread of affliction. But it serves as a reminder to do all these things. We need reminders. We're still flesh and blood. We need reminders. The unleavened bread is a type. It's a reminder. But the choice to obey God in eating it is real. It shows that because Christ now works in us, that given the opportunity to choose, we would choose the tree of life. The tree of life is usually associated with plentiful water, like we just read. The picture is one of satisfied thirst. The life represented by the tree of life is as much about quality as it is quantity. Throughout the Bible are many stories, examples, warnings, all overlaid on this one template, this one central theme. Everlasting satisfaction is only available by following God through Christ and not leaning on our own understanding. So for the next week, as we eat unleavened bread, we are being reminded that by choosing to do God's will and not our own, we are, in a sense, eating from the tree of life.